IT businesses in Sacramento, California.
From somewhere deep in the cloud and the corners of the earth, this is the Killing It Podcast, with a focus on helping you make sense and dollars of all things IT, with your hosts, Dave Sobel, Ryan Morris, and Carl Polachuk.
Welcome to episode 71 of the Killing It Podcast. I'm Carl, joined today, as always, by Ryan and Dave. Welcome, gentlemen.
Welcome.
Nice to be back.
Not even going to ask where you are. Don't care.
Yes, from a targeting point of view, I'm exactly in the same location.
You haven't said anything new in 5 months, so I'm just going to stop asking.
It's kind of true. It's going to be the same. It's going to be a constant. We just are.
The world keeps changing around us, which is good, because that allows us to actually have a show.
True. It'd be super boring if nothing ever changed and we were just making this stuff
so up. The good news is there's actually way more stories than we can possibly cover. So we're just going to jump in and take care of a few of them. So I think one of my favorite stories this week was last week, it will be when this airs, the grilling of the big tech executives by Congress, which, to be honest, is more show than anything else, but it does bring up some important points. And, you know, to me anyway, the anti-competitive nature is important. And, you know, it's also true, one of the biggies is, are they monopolies? And I don't know that anybody has answered either one of those questions, but I'm not seeing a lot of evil that I would expect from most of them. I do have to say, even though I'm a stockholder of Amazon, I do see some evil out of Amazon.
So what was first off, I would be remiss if I did not point out, Mr. Bezos, you're on mute, was one of my favorite lines of the entire show. I would be remiss. I watched the whole thing. I actually watched it in real time to kind of break it down. And what was striking to me first off was the Democratic representatives were on point with very targeted, specific information and had done their homework. They came in with understanding of the thing that they were asking about, with specific evidence that had been pulled from it. And I thought a number of those pieces were just pretty damning. They were specifically able to call out Mark Zuckerberg on purchasing Instagram and specific statements of taking out competition, like just very, very targeted, specific examples of Amazon leveraging against third parties and destroying their businesses, like very, very targeted.
Yeah, I mean, to me, the Amazon examples were better because I have to say, when I look at, you know, I mean, yeah, Facebook is monstrous and huge and whatever, but there's no shortage of other outlets, right? And anybody anywhere can, you know, put up a podcast, put up a community, you know, create their own environment online and compete for that. You know, I don't know that you can have a monopoly on something like social media.
Well, I think that I think you can, and I think that is his stated objective, contrary to what his testimony was. I think, you know, like if Jeff Bezos being muted was one thing of entertainment, I got a little bit of a kick out of how defensive Mr. Zuckerberg was. Each of the questions, he seemed to ratchet it up a little bit. And it indicated to me that he approached this with a little bit more like pre-defensiveness than any of the others did. It reminded me of, you know, what everybody was talking about, the last big congressional hearing about this topic was when Bill Gates had to go in person that time and testify in front of a committee about whether or not Microsoft was using monopolistic and anti-competitive behaviors. This time around, I did not feel any iota of the danger that I felt then, right? Like, I've been around the industry long enough that when he got called, I've competed against Microsoft. I've sold for them. I know where they are in this industry. And there was a legitimate sense back then, like the government might actually do something about this and break Microsoft into two or more companies. at absolutely no point in the lead up or the execution of this hearing did I have any sense that anybody intended to do anything like that. And that is not a measurement of whether or not they are behaving anti-competitively, because I believe they are. I think it's just we've moved the finish line enough that people are, we're all just a little numb to the fact that, well, you know, these big four companies are going to buy everybody. They will squelch anybody. That's going to happen in the marketplace. And we all just kind of go, ho-hum, yeah, I guess that's the way it is now. I don't think that's the proper reaction to what they are doing, because I do believe that Instagram story was pretty damning. And I do think that Amazon has been shown in beyond their technology in any way, shape, or form, just their business behavior, there are some questionable things that they do. And almost everybody has just basically admitted, looking for a soundbite. I want to criticize you in public. I ain't going to do anything about it because there's no consensus.
See, I disagree, but I think I do think that there are some obvious things that came out. First off, remember, there is a whole investigation going on behind this, where this is more a bit of a public face to it. Right. Let me observe that every single person, the people that are up there are all running for re-election. Okay. Yeah. So now, but more importantly, they're also gauging public reaction. So one of the important pieces of that is not just necessarily like, are we going to catch one of these guys in a lie? We kind of did, but that's not as important as I make these statements. It may be the only time that large portions of the general populace even think about lawmakers moving on these things. And they'll get some reaction to this. They'll get a sense whether or not, as politicians, are they getting public support behind this or are they not?
And that does advance the conversation.
And it advances. I position it and say, like, if that is the goal, because I believe that more, I wasn't expecting them to come out and like decide something based on just the hearing. What I did think was that they presented a bunch of the findings and investigation that they've done and found there to be some lacking problem.
Well, and
if you put that out to the public and the public reacts, you find that you have political viability for moving.
And you also have to remember the context of this. Remember the last time, or maybe it was the first time, but not the last time, they had these guys up there, and they basically, Congress had no idea what they were doing. So they were like asking Zuckerberg, how should we regulate you? Like what would you accept and what do you think is a good idea? I mean, they literally had no idea. Now they actually have some idea of what this means. And it's interesting that the arguments against these companies are so different, but it appears to be Congress versus really big tech companies versus, you know, looking, because I don't think Facebook is that vicious compared to Amazon. I don't think Apple is that vicious compared to Amazon, right? Well, so, you know, it's like Amazon will take your product, steal it, compete against you, and crush you while giving, you know, while taking most of the money along the way. You know, I mean, that sort of, that has a lot to do with anti-competitiveness. That's different from being a monopoly.
So I'll make some predictions. Okay. Just because, so where do I think I have some thoughts on where I think this is going. I think nothing will change for Apple. I think Apple has managed to sidestep and show themselves as reasonably competent and will likely avoid any major problems with this. I think they're going to come for the minute because it has a very obvious break them up story that makes perfect sense. You break up Instagram, WhatsApp, and Facebook, and you pull them back apart, which is totally doable. And you've got a bit of a solution to that. And I think it's just kind of obvious, particularly when they were with the line of reasoning of attacking exactly that. I think the other two will have rules imposed about the difference, because they're trying to manage as both the platform and sellers on the platform, particularly when you think about it from an advertising perspective, or you think about it from their third-party seller marketplace for Google and Amazon respectively. I expect we will see some legislation to attempt to fix that. So I think those are that would be my set of predictions of how this is going to go. We'll see if it plays out that way.
Well, and see, if you will flash back several months when we did a segment on a list of the evil companies in our industry, all four of these companies were on that list for different reasons. And what's fascinating is mostly not for the reasons that this hearing was about, except for Amazon, right? Amazon was and on that list and analyzed according to their anti-competitive tendencies. The other three, it was data privacy and actual security and data protection kinds of problems, as well as some of their marketing and capitalization techniques, not for their anti-competitive behavior. So what I came away with was everybody wanted a photo op. Everybody wanted to say something loud in public. They did that. And yet what really needs to be fixed, again, about all four, but especially three of them, it's not monopoly behavior that I'm concerned with, right? Like, I think the problem with Facebook is not that they are eating the world. It's that they are not respecting the rules of data privacy and the way they capitalize on this.
Well, the other thing
is still to be determined.
When you talk about breaking them up, I have to flash back to the last time the government broke up somebody big, which was the phone company, which was followed by not really much less competition, and then a period of free for all. We got the internet out of it, and then they all gobbled each other up again and became one company again. So there's that. And then the other example is Microsoft, and Ryan alluded to this, but Microsoft's case, the government's case against Microsoft, was settled by a consent decree in which they agreed to certain kinds of behavior. And I think that's far more likely with Facebook and Amazon, certainly, than it is breaking them up in any way. So maybe that's just like a more modern tool.
We'll see. And there's one final little stylistic observation. Again, for the love, people, we've been in our offices now for how many months? Learn how to set your laptop up on a book and put that camera at eye level, Mr. Zuckerberg. Like, we don't need people glaring down into the camera to make us feel like you're trying any harder to be Darth Vader.
See, I can't top that. So I'm going to move us right along then. I can't top that statement. So I'm going to throw one out here for discussion, because I think it's interesting and indicative of some of the changes in our industry. So Microsoft Inspire was recently, and I've covered a number of different stories coming out of there on my Business of Tech podcast. I wanted to bring one to this group for discussion, because I think it's really interesting what it means. SolarWinds, and specifically the SolarWinds MSP group, announced a partnership with Microsoft to integrate Intune into their management technology, specifically their RMM and central technologies. But for those that may not be familiar, their RMM tech space. They're going to integrate the two so that you get all of the Intune capabilities within those products and two-way sync. I actually attended their webinar discussing that as well, which for those that are now listening to this, it was the previous week, where they announced the two working together, and they're leveraging all of the open APIs that are available within the platform to bring the two together. I think this is super interesting, and I'll throw it to you guys because I want to hear your take on it. My take was that, you know, it's super interesting to see a company like SolarWinds, who's done so much of the stuff around driving these managed services tech, from my perspective, abdicate a space. I think, by the way, it's a smart move. I think it's smart for them to embrace a best-in-class. Microsoft is really killing it in terms of their moves here, and their Intune stuff is really powerful. But what they're also saying is, by integrating the two, SolarWinds is saying, yeah, we're not going to build that. We're not going to build the MDM and security management stuff that's in Intune. We're just going to let Microsoft take that bit. And I wanted to hear what you guys thought.
So I think the first thing that comes to mind for me is SolarWinds is mature enough that they can do this, right? That they realize that the RMM piece is a commodity. It's funny. I had a conversation with one of the top people at an RMM company about 16 years ago, who said to me at the time when it was fresh and new and everybody was trying to figure out who to go with. And he said the words to me, you know, this tool is a commodity and it's just a matter of time before somebody's either going to pick us or pick somebody else and it's not going to make any difference. And I'm like, please tell me that this is not being recorded because you have just shot yourself in the foot. But now here we are 16 years later and it's okay to say, look, that our tool is good. It's just not as good as that. And so why would we spend millions and millions and millions of dollars connecting through an API to something that is not the best in breed?
See, and this is the natural order of evolution and maturing, not just in the RMM space, not just in managed services or in technology. Every industry that has ever existed goes through this evolving cycle. Think about the automobile industry, the pharmaceutical industry, very disparate deliverables that you're actually selling to your customer. One person invents something. Many people think it is excellent. They invent copycats. We compete on feature function. We standardize, we stabilize, we consolidate, and we get back to what is ultimately an operating system platform. Think about the electrical grid. Think about the airline industry. There are competing ways that you could do every one of those things, except that eventually everybody goes, you know, if we built the railroad system with proprietary gauges on the tracks and your trains could only run on your tracks and not on mine and vice versa, we would all be less efficient. We would all be brutally inefficient in our market coverage. Eventually, we all just go, you know what's a good idea? Let's standardize the connective tissue, and then we will innovate on top of that platform. Now, this is not to say that there is either no more money in the RMM space or that there's not mountains of innovation yet to still happen in this category. If you've ever hired a plumber who is there to work on your standard connection to the street water, or an electrician, if you called one of those guys to your house in the last 12 months, you know for a fact there's still a lot of money to be made in managing and servicing standard local infrastructure. That is a lucrative profession, and it will continue to be in our business. Looking forward, the question is, cool, now that that's standard, now what?
Right. And I said this in my fictional MSP discussion that I've thrown out to the internet, where if I was founding one today, I'd go all in on Microsoft, like Azure AD, Intune. Well, I have to smile and go, looks like I've been proven right by the large choices of product managers at an RMM. When I say, like, there's something to this Intune thing, they seem to agree with me.
It's interesting because on many, many fronts, Microsoft and other big software companies, whether that's Salesforce or, you know, Infusionsoft or whoever, they put out something and they only go so far because they really don't care about the last mile, right? Because there are integrators whose job is to make the last mile happen. And there are people that do absolutely nothing except make Microsoft's interface more usable to real human beings, right? So, you know, the resellers all over have made it much easier to sell Microsoft Office 365 than the Microsoft interface. There's a lot of vendors or a lot of partners who just say, look, Microsoft's interface sucks, so I'm going to go with, you know, and then pick your favorite reseller. And so Microsoft isn't really going to change your business at all, right?
They need to be part of it. And that's the piece.
They're shifting how you do it, and they're making it Microsoft-centric.
Well, and again, they will change the interior tools that you use for systems administration that are transparent to the end user. The end user does not know or care when you change your plumbing like that, but it does call into question what is your business value proposition going forward. It is not probably in selling these particular tools because the markup on commodities tends to be brutal, but the hourly rate and the SLA associated with consistent, reliable, professional delivery of this commodity that we all count on. If I flip on the light switch, I know that there's probably a $6 part somewhere in the house that will prevent it, the lights from going on. It's not a $6 problem for me, right? Like when the power goes out, I have to get somebody who knows how without burning down my house and has the time and the expertise and that $6 part and everything that goes with it. The part that you is being commoditized is not your business value proposition. If you think it is, you're about to be a dinosaur. Now, what is your business value proposition? Local service and customer support. You got to go get the customer. You got to treat them well. Got to customize and personalize to their specific situation and then maintain that relationship over an extended period of time.
So the end user shouldn't care, probably doesn't care what RMM you use or what PSA you use or whether or not they're integrated or whether one of them just relies on an API to Microsoft. Should the IT service provider care, right? Is it a reason to choose SolarWinds or not choose SolarWinds based on their relationship with the RMM?
I think so. And again, I believe it is. There's, you know, again, you think about my standard model about the four phases of market maturity and how things evolve. In stage two of that market, it is about the dominant model is a technician who can take multiple disparate tools, integrate them into a proprietary system, and deliver integrated features that nobody else can do. And then when that gets standardized, that's no longer a differentiator, and you move to phase three where the value proposition is on marketing, sales, and customer acquisition, because anybody can just go, well, yeah, whatever their SLA is, I got that too, and I'll do it for cheaper. That good enough me too evolution in the technical phase is about to land hard in the IT service provider industry. You are no longer the only one on your block who can deliver that SLA. Anybody can, even if they just started the practice, like Dave said, yesterday. They just build a brand new one and they can go, oh yeah, industry standard APIs, everything's there. Got you covered. Let's talk about your business side, right? Like that's about to happen in our industry now.
Well, it certainly gives us a lot to think about because, you know, we can see the pieces moving this way. These are open APIs. Everything that they're doing here is, you know, they by their own admission is strength of the relationship, not a technical difference. Maybe others will replicate. Maybe they won't. I think it's worth, it's certainly something I'm going to be watching.
Yep.
All righty.
Excellent. Well, let's move into our topic number three then. And as we have our format over the last few months evolved into, this one is where we look forward to what the world will be like when we get back out of the present disruptive trench. We came across an article that I was very jazzed up. Like, I read a lot of things. And every now and then they make me stand up out of my chair and pace around and throw my hands around because whatever the idea was, it was just so dynamic. This one hit that button, right? So the topic is the evolutionary threat to the higher education industry, your local college and university, and what will happen to them post-COVID and even I in a microcosm during COVID and then specifically post-COVID. The basic thesis was, no matter how good the school is, no matter how long the history is, there are two dimensions where you have to be able to evaluate the survivability of a higher ed institution. It is, do you have a bucket full of money somewhere stored away that will carry you through the current economic downturn? And do you have a brand that will distinguish you whether people show up on campus or not? And I thought those two dimensions in the analysis were fascinating. And I will say, love to see where any individual school falls on this. You can disagree with the analysis of any single school, but the fact that it freaked out and pissed off all these university administrators in the comments section made me go, It is on target. I believe we are on the hot button.
There might be a there there.
So I'm a total Prof G, Professor Galloway fanboy. I freely admit it. So when you shared this, it was like, oh, it's one of my favorites. So, because he's one of those guys that I just consume everything of his. He's been talking about the idea of disruption in higher education for a while. He talks about the tiering that we see in the tier ones, tier twos, tier three, the fact that universities, he has been saying for ages that they're not going back in the fall, that it's all just garbage to try and get the money to come in because they desperately need the revenues. And by the way, it's proving to be very true as they say they're going back on campus, and the closer we get, the more and more they're falling like dominoes to actually not. For me, first off, the analysis process is super interesting. And I think, Ryan, for you to call on, you're exactly right. You can quibble some of the data, and it does amuse me how many of the comments are like, well, you got this data point wrong. I got that data point. It's like, well, you're missing the point, everybody. the point is around the idea. First off, higher education is a realm for disruption. You know, it is, from his analysis, and I would agree with the statement, incredibly high margins, like 97% margin on it, where you're charging a premium. And as that got disrupted and moved online, you clearly see that the value you're getting is not quite at the price that you're getting, particularly when you look at, mediocre online education is just a translated version that sometimes, if not all those classes are great. You're buying the reputation, or you're buying the experience, or buying the package. But when you move it online, not so much.
Gotta say, I'm, first of all, just, as a side note, happy that my alma maters, Gonzaga and the University of Michigan, are both in the upper right-hand quadrant there.
No quibbles with that data.
So I have no complaints about this data whatsoever. But it's interesting because in education is the one thing where you look from maybe not kindergarten, but first grade up through college, kind of what you would expect to have happened, right? First graders, second graders, fifth graders, like those are not environments where you just go and do total online learning. Colleges, there's a lot of people that have already been doing that, right? It's been very common for a lot of these colleges to say, hey, we do have classes in your community, but we also have the online thing. So everybody, this basically what happened is everybody who'd already figured it out is on the right side of that, right? they're on the higher value side of this because they already knew how. And a perfect example, is Harvard. First of all, you mentioned cash. I think right. Harvard has more cash than the rest of the world combined. But they have enough endowments that they literally never have to charge anybody for tuition ever again if they choose not to. But they charge foreigners tuition. And those foreigners know they're willing to pay it because it's the brand name, right? And the second thing is, Harvard put every single class they have online a long time ago. This is not their first rodeo. It's not like they scurried around in March and said, oh my God, what are we going to do? Everybody who's on the high value side was already producing online classes. And so, it's only those who are scurrying to catch up who are finding themselves on the lower end of the.
This is a fundamental example of the market forces driving innovation and yielding a whole lot of extinction, right? Like this is a market economy that is moving forward. You can either go with it or become increasingly irrelevant. Now, what's interesting in this case is those that are from the left side of that analysis, they are storied institutions in many cases. They've been around forever. We are the industry of higher learning. And they have actively avoided and been quite upset when anybody suggested that they might need to adapt or evolve their model. It is absolutely not okay to just do it the way you've always done it. Harvard's logo goes back hundreds of years and the brand equity is phenomenal. But Harvard's brand is more informed by the fact that they will always be a market leader, and that brand logo because they think in that kind of a transformational way. Other schools who are not thinking that way, they will be disrupted. And this is something, again, I go back, Clay Christensen, a guy that I read a lot, and he was a Harvard man. He had been around the thinking of the industry for many, many years. And many years ago, he said, this is an industry ripe for disruption. And people's main objection to his analysis was, this is about learning and culture and society. It's not about revenue. How dare you suggest that? Let me just say to anybody who's not already fundamentally aware, whether you are K-12 or higher ed, it is still a business. They still have customers. They still have revenue sources. They still make the same kinds of commercial trade-offs. Anybody who ever tried to sell back your textbooks at the end of the semester understands the profit markup and that this is in fact a business. You either evolve or you become a dinosaur, and so many institutions are not. This is a phenomenal opportunity for a technology systems integrator solution provider. You can take these institutions and lead them to the future with your technology platform savvy. That is something that must happen or they will go away. What a fantastic opportunity.
Also, there's a lesson to be taken there in terms of the thinking around capacity, physical versus virtual, and the different dynamics that you can do. I mean, one of the major pieces of this and why those premium brands will thrive is because if they move towards a hybrid or an online world, they can instantly expand capacity and then drive down the rest of the market. This is a lesson that applies to other markets as well. If you can expand it through virtual means, you can then, you know, take a more dominant space, particularly with a strong brand. So it's something that can be applied to other industries as well.
Yes, 70,000 students at the university used to be busting at the seams. Now, hey, I'm sure we could figure out a server cluster to get all those guys on one Zoom call.
Exactly. And I would say, you know, if they took this down a notch and looked at community colleges, I think that you would find many, many of them would be on the high value and less vulnerable quadrants, simply because community colleges have done online courses in much larger percentages than four-year colleges for a long, long time. And it's sort of interesting that, you know, some of them are now pushing to become two-year/four-year colleges. And at the same time, something like this comes out, it's like, maybe the value is actually there because, you know, at least in California, you know, it's $1 billion a year to go to the UC system. Well, almost.
Close enough.
Close enough. Trust me on this one, having written a few checks to UC San Diego. But you know, the community colleges are still cheap, at least for us, right? So, you know, a lot of people are like, hey, I'm going to save me $100,000 and get the first couple of years out of a community college. And now, if the quality is there, then there's absolutely no reason not to.
Yep. And see, we don't want anybody to take this conversation and be like, oh, these guys don't believe in colleges or universities. No, we've had that conversation before in depth where higher education and the hard skills and soft skills are absolutely essential to the progress of our society.
Yes, sir.
We want everybody to continue to learn. It's just, now you got to learn to do it in a different way. It's not going to be in an ivy covered building. It's going to be in a phenomenally technology enabled and dependent interaction. And I think that's good for all of us.
Well, we'll have to see how it plays out. I was also thankful to see that my school ended up in the Thrive bucket. So there's also always that, that element where you're looking going, well, how'd my school do?
Exactly. Exactly. All right. Very cool. Well, thank you, gentlemen. This has been very fun and exciting. And this has been episode 71 of the Killing It Podcast.
Thanks for tuning in to the Killing It Podcast. Please share with your friends and tell everyone to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, and all the podcast places. Join us next week and help us keep killing it in the technology business.